Welcome to another episode, another fine episode of the Good Music Show, starring, featuring, hosted by, led by Danny and Julius. I'm your co-host, Danny Robbins, here for another week. And with me, as always, is my co-host, Julius. Say what's up.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? What's up?
Well, it's another week of talking about good music. And we got a good one for you today. This is going to be a very extra personal one because the theme that we decided on was sentimental favorite albums. And we got All Eyes on Me by Tupac, which Julius gave me.
And I have Redheaded Stranger by Willie Nelson
that I gave Julius. And yeah. We got a couple picks that. Well, I'll speak for myself. I can't speak for you yet because I don't know yet. We've been keeping our thoughts and opinions very secretive, and we've got our notes locked down under lock and key and password protected and all that. But this album for me is one of those ones that is just one that I can put on at any time and enjoy it and find new things in it. And I'm looking forward to talking about that a little later. We're going to talk about the album that Julius gave me, All Eyes on Me by Tupac. Came out February 13th, 1996. And Julius, why don't you tell us about why you picked this album as one of your sentimental favorites?
Yeah, so we're getting sentimental on this episode of The Good Music Show. And All Eyes on Me is probably the first album I maybe have heard. Because memories, they're a very tricky thing. The older we get, the tougher they are to keeping your fucking thought bubble. But for me, a memory that doesn't fade away at all, which to me, it could be a fake one or whatever, but it's always been, even when I was a kid, was just being a child overhearing my dad listen to Two of America's Most Wanted by Tupac and Snoop Dogg on the album. I feel like the first thing I heard in life is, it's just a motherfucking gangster party. That's what I first remember. And I remember as soon as I had the opportunity to have a CD player and stuff, I ran this album back so many times because I was just obsessed with that moment of just hearing such an incredible song. And my dad was a huge, huge Tupac fan, huge, obsessed. And from that, I became a huge fan as well, where it was an album that wasn't necessarily a comeback album because his last album was huge. It was enormous, Me Against the World. But it was an album that he dropped right after, getting out of jail. And it was, unfortunately, the last album he dropped in his lifetime, where he got bailed out of the classic story that everyone knows. He got bailed out of jail from with Suge Knight, signed to Death Row Records. And it was at the midst of the crazy East Coast, West Coast beef, which I'm glad that after their passings, it was a beef that everyone immediately was just this was stupid. Too many people made money off of our disputes and stuff. But unfortunately, this was at the midst of it. Mm-hmm. And it definitely led to the peak of it, where Tupac pretty much figuratively came out guns a-blazing, where one of my favorite fun facts with this album is the first song on the album, Ambitious as a Rider, was the first song he recorded when he got out of jail. He told Daz, give me a motherfucking beat, and that's the first thing he recorded. That's the first track on the album. And it's an incredible fucking song. If you're going to hear one Tupac song in your life, somehow if you never heard California Love or Hit 'Em Up, check out Ambitious of a Rider, because that will convert you immediately. There's no cooler song. Mike Tyson, heavyweight champion Mike Tyson, many other things. So check his personal life section on Wikipedia. That was
this the controversies song. Tab is long.
Yeah, that was the song that he would walk out to, man, which to me encapsulates how fucking great that song is. The hardest, scariest motherfucker of the 90s besides OJ Simpson had that as his theme, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So but yeah, it's very sentimental because it gave me a lot of lessons on dealing with standing up for yourself, thoughts of how to deal with people who are hating on you, dealing with just when you feel the world, which of course you had Omni after, but it still carries that stigma of isolation, feeling everyone's working against you, that paranoia and stuff. And I was a kid who was definitely isolated to an extent of in school and stuff, I was bullied and shit. This song was very much something that I went to as a cave to as an echo chamber to make those thoughts be yo, it's cool, man. You're going to be all right. You're going to fucking get out of this because Pac did. Not really, but I told myself that. You know what I mean? Yeah. But yeah, where it very much jump-started a huge, huge obsession with hip-hop. And it's an album that I still hold dear to my heart, despite I do have my own personal critiques of it, like outside of going out of like the being a fan of Pac and stuff. Which the quick thing is that it's a double album. And unfortunately, almost every double album can be cut down a little bit. And Pac, a revolutionary in so many ways, he revolutionized the act of being a rapper and being like, fuck it, just drop everything I recorded, despite you don't need to do that. Most albums don't need to be over 10 songs. But anyway.
Yeah.
How did you feel about it, Danny?
Yeah. So, I was definitely one of those ones that didn't know a lot about Tupac. I mean, I was a baby when he was at his most popular and when he died. And of course, there was a few songs I knew going into it. Definitely California Love, of course. Like, I don't think you can get away without hearing that at some point being in America. But I did know Ambitions as a Rider. And then a couple of the other songs, like All About You and All Eyes on Me, like the hooks were so familiar that I was like, okay, I've definitely heard those at some point. It's just, I never really listened to them in a critical way. But I actually did, like, in some of my, like, like going back through rap and stuff, I listened to Me Against the World.
Yeah.
That album I loved, and specifically I really love that slap of the snare drum that kind of goes all on it, like, you know, songs like Old School and If I Died Tonight.
Yeah. Incredible production on that album front to back. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, Dear Mama's on that one. So, like, that album front to back was one that I really loved, but I never went beyond that in depth. So I was I thought this was a great one to kind of, like, I guess, get to know Tupac. You know, because this album features a lot of the stuff you're saying about, like, paranoia and stuff like that.
Not to cut you off, but I also feel like, from listening to this album, you get like a taste of like some of the most unique artists in the 90s, because don't let anyone tell you that rap is like just very monolithic. Like, all the rappers sound the same. All the rappers are doing the same flows. Like, rap is always going to have insane diversity of styles, of flows, of lyrics, all of it, you know, identities and all of that. Where All Eyes on Me, thankfully, due to him, like, you know, while he was a guy who like hated on a lot of rappers, Tupac was very much a rapper who loved rap, you know, like he had his favorite people, his favorite artists who he thought was slept on and shit, where this album has a lot of features from artists on Death Row, but also like artists from the East Coast. Even like, it has Method Man and Redman on there. They have like Sebo, who is like one of the most underrated West Coast rappers out there, which I think is just cool that he gets to showcase some of his skills on the song Trade and War Stories. You got the Immortal Nate Dogg doing, I believe, two or three hooks on there, which All About You is such a funny fucking song, because there's no good morals or lessons from it. It's very much just classic West Coast misogyny. Every other city we go, every other video, no matter where I go, I see the same hole. Every other city we go, every other video,
The
beat and the hook and just the raps are just so entertaining. You can't deny it. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny too, because even at the end of that song, like, Snoop Dogg is like,
"Don't get mad, I'm only being real.
Don't get mad, I'm just being real." You know?
Like, funny. like just even go even more deeper, is like the features they have like one of my favorite tracks on undeniably is Can't See Me with George Clinton. Insane track, where it just fully, like, Banner's G-Funk just fully becomes full-blown P-Funk, you know? Insane hook, insane Dr. Dre beat, and Pac just, runs with the show on it, where I think if anyone who's, like, trying to get into Pac or just even get into 90s rap, this is, like, a great entry point despite the length, because you get to, like, see so many, like, talented artists who usually don't get that much showcase, because a lot of 90s rap is just mostly, like, you know, check out Nas Illmatic, check out MF Doom, check out Quest, where West Coast, unfortunately, is still very, like, you know, undervalued for a lot of, like, today's music listeners, you know? But, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think just kind of overall, like, it does have those markers of the sound of, you know, the 90s, West Coast. It's got Dr. Dre on it and a few tracks, and I don't even know what you would call that that sound. It just makes me think of Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. Like the
yeah, no. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because that is like, I love that album's, I love that game's soundtrack so much because it is like, for our generation specifically, a great gateway to this sound because I had a lot of old Dre, had NWA, had Cube, Too Short, who is like a rapper I could talk all day about. And Pac is on there, you know, where like a lot of that.
I was going to say the soundtrack's got good rock and country too.
Yeah.
And it's got a lot of good stuff. And then the radio, I was actually listening to the, because this kind of got me thinking about that game. And I was listening to the radio station of like the country. And of course they try to do like the, like the lady like trying to be like a vulgar Southern woman, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway,
I love those games because they are very much just South Park type humor. They do not give a fuck about accuracy. They're just throwing it. They're like, suddenly,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's very cartoonish. But yeah, I think you have those tracks on here that have that sound that's kind of like, you know, it might date it in a way, but there's also a lot of stuff on there that is very, you can tell the influence of modern rap music. Like there's some, like we'll get into like the certain tracks that stuck out to me because we won't cover every single track. But there's just a lot of like production techniques that definitely push things further to where it's not just that all. You know, like, which is great, by the way. It's just like you don't want to listen to just that.
Yeah, it's not all G-Funk, which like definitely originated with like God, I'm trying to remember the name of this group, because of course people like to give it up for Dre, despite like Dr. Dre, regardless of one deny or not, amazing rap producer, but unfortunately has a lot of like cases of like plagiarism and blah blah blah, where you could like just Google Dre stealing beats, you'll find like several conspiracy minded but some factual shit articles and stuff. But like growing up, like it definitely was a sound that was like originated with like DJ Quick, Cold 187, which was like he was the producer for like a group called Above the Law, where Dre very much like just like any great producer heard the sound and brought his own spin to it, which definitely blew it up. Like you can't deny that motherfucker brought his own style to it and like gave it the like oomph that made it like the big thing it was. But like while it has like a lot of that on the album, it definitely has like a lot of like, you know, diversity in sound. Like there's one song that samples the Rugrats theme song, which I think is fucking insane.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
I did not catch that one.
Me and my brother Christian used to make fun of this fucking song all the time. Wonder Why They Call You Bitch. Like, because it's already just the title alone is very much like, okay, what's this gonna be about? It is what it is. It's very much a slut shaming song. It's just literally him being like, oh, you wonder why? It's just literally, it's an ugly, regressive song. But for whatever reason, the guy who produced it, which I have the Wikipedia page up, so it's probably not too accurate, but it's credited to Johnny J and Tupac, where one of them was like watching Rugrats, and suddenly was just like, hey, yo.
Yeah, that song, though, like it ends with a particularly intense verse where he's describing a woman that like gets AIDS and dies. And he's like, I wonder why. Like, I don't know.
It goes back in on itself, and it's like still influential because, like, if you check out Kendrick's stuff, for example, who's like almost every popular modern rapper who we call GOATs now, because no person, at least younger than us, is saying Tupac or Biggie are the GOATs anymore. They don't even listen to Tupac and Biggie, where they usually point to like Drake, Pac, Kanye, and J. Cole. And all four of those rappers are all influenced by Pac in their own way. And Kendrick is interesting in how he's influenced by it, because Kendrick very much isn't trying to rap like Pac, but he very much is trying to deal with the same subject matter and philosophies, you know? Mm-hmm. Where Keisha's song is very reminiscent of that kind of like, I hate you, woman, but I care about you. That's why I hate you. Where it's like, I don't want you to be a slut, but stop being a slut. Where it's like, this isn't helpful at all for anyone, you know? Mm-hmm. Where it's very much, the reason I bring it up is that like, it's not a product of its time. It's unfortunately a mentality that has been normalized through albums like this being as successful as they are, you know? But but it's a part of an album that covers a lot of many things, which is why I'm not going to have like one song fuck up the ball of a double album.
Right. No, I mean, it does. You can't really ignore that whole side of it, too, because it is a huge part of it. And, you know, like it's definitely like, it's the result of, you know, a guy like Tupac, like, who's not, who's very opinionated and not afraid to say whatever comes to his mind in a very defiant way, which is what gets people riled up. And that's how you have these, like, very, like, energetic, like, songs that, you know, that he puts out. But, like, I mean, he, you can't really ignore, like, because he was one of the, like, I guess I can't say the first, but he's probably the one you'd point to where it's, like, the whole, like, controversy where people debate about the merits of rap, and it's, like, describe it as just like it's all about violence.
You have to, like, because, like, we both, I'm sure, agree on that, like, no act that is criminal or whatever is being committed because of someone listening to a song, listening to an album, right, watching a movie, playing a game, whatever you fucking accuse it of, it doesn't come down to that. But it does lead to the normalization of it all, where it just amplifies that attitude. Where it's not at fault for it, but very much is just like something that, like, in the hands of, like, an irresponsible mind, it can, like, people, if they want to, they can pinpoint to it, despite that's really not the reason for it. It's institutional reasons that we're ignoring because it's easier to point at a work of art. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like the whole, like, bias thing where it's like your brain wants to see patterns. And, you know, like, if anyone did, like, do things in real life that we would all say are, like, you know, terrible and, you know, unacceptable, and you hear a song that talks about the same thing, it's easy to just point to just do be the Spider-Man meme where it's, like, pointing at each other or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's like this, it's not like this person would go, like, there's a more deeper issue at root. It's just easier to find the parallel.
I listen to so much gangster rap, but I have never... I never successfully joined a gang. I haven't even successfully shot a gun on target more than once. I shot a can successfully once, but outside of that, nothing at all. Whereas, like, this isn't the juice that's going to give anyone the powers to become the defiant gangster that everyone thinks these music creates and stuff. But and Pac did have a rep for that. He was very much a rapper that everyone pointed at in the 90s of, like, he's the thing that's causing all this stuff for kids, as if the government had no involvement themselves. But not to get off track, but it's a thing that, like, you know, is part of the context of the album's, like, history. That this album was considered, like, a lot of songs out here are considered dangerous, and the album itself is responding to it as well, especially with, like, when you see the music video for Two of America's Most Wanted, they're both in court because they both actually were on trial pretty recently. You know, like, Snoop Dogg was almost close to going to jail for a murder rap. Mm-hmm. And, like, Pac literally was just in jail, where it very much, like, made, like, this album was very much influential of just, like, very much being responsive to the things around these artists and putting it into the music as much as, like, Kanye does with a lot of his, like, music currently. Like, Life of Pablo wouldn't be the way it was if he didn't have the year that he had when he made that album, you know? Where All Eyes on Me isn't the first example of it, but, like, it very much is, like, one of the first really successful examples of, like, people are following the tabloids, so they check the album to get the response to the tabloids. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's just, like, it's reflections of what's going on in their real lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's worth saying, too, like, I've been, because of your recommendation, I've been getting into Scarface, and he has that song that's, like, you know, like, the stuff I'm rapping about isn't any different than, like, what's in a Western or whatever like that. Mm-hmm. But because all of a sudden it's, like, a black man speaking his mind about the stuff, then it's a problem, you know?
Exactly. Exactly, you know.
So. And, yeah, you know, you could point to a million, you know, like, again, like, country albums where, like, Johnny Cash was a good example. Just people sing about murder and death and awful things. It doesn't mean you're endorsing it. It's like a conversation that for some reason that we keep have to have because people just overreact about this type of thing.
Exactly. Exactly. What was do you have, like, what are some of your favorite moments or tracks off of this?
Yeah. Let me just give a little, like, kind of general thoughts too.
You
mentioned the features. That's a huge part of the album. My assumption was that these are all people that are, like, either friends or very close friends of Tupac. Is that pretty accurate to say?
Especially
like on side two, like all the Outlaws, like his group.
Oh yeah, the Outlaws was very much his, like, group by the end of his career, where they've been around for almost all of it. Like, originally they were referred to as, like, Thug Life. Like, Thug Life was a group. They have, like, one album that has, like, one of his, like, best songs ever on it, where I just say check out the whole tape. But but Outlaws is what that group, I believe, evolved into, where most of the members became that thing. And where that was probably his closest sense of, like, community that he had by the end of his career, because his paranoia even got to the point where a lot of Death Row Records didn't want to work with him after this album, where Dre and Pac, which a lot of people don't really know just because California Love, you know, the video, you see them, they're all buddies and stuff. They weren't really that cool with each other by the end of like Pac's life. Like by the time Pac came into Death Row, Dre was already getting ready to leave the record label himself because he got tired of all of the like Suge Knight, the like gang affiliations and stuff, and all of the like danger on it, where he was getting back to the whole thing of like, I just want to make music, you know, which is corny, but it's a sentiment that I can kind of get. And where California Love wasn't even meant to be a Tupac song. That song was already made and done. And it was supposed to be Dre's single getting out of Death Row. But I don't know who's behind it. It could have been Suge. It could have been anybody. But they gave it a Pac as like his big out there single, which is something that Dre at the time was really upset about. Where on Pac's, technically his actualized album, which is Don Kill Your Mahdi, which it's technically posthumous because, like, is that how you say posthumous or posthumous or what is it?
Yeah, I think I say posthumous.
Posthumous. I said posthumous. Like, on Don Kill Your Mahdi, most of the features on there is just the Outlaws because at that point, they were the only people he was, like, trustworthy of. Because, like, well, that album, he has a lot of disses towards Dre and everything. Where, like, I'm just talking about here because, like, the classic misconception, especially because Dre himself, like, likes amplifying it on his later stuff. They're like, yeah, man, me and Pac were buddies. We were best buddies and stuff. But, like, it unfortunately, it wasn't really the truth, especially if you go into the music. But the reason why I bring up Don Kill Your Mahdi as well is that, like, it's not necessarily an album after death, because a lot of it was finished by the time he was, like, gone, which is why I consider that to be his real last album. Whereas All Eyes on Me is, like, it's his debut as this big Death Row rapper and stuff, you know? But, yeah, but a lot of features, as you assume, are favorites of his. Like, Rappin' Forte is a rapper that he was a big fan of, E-40. Were cool with him and stuff too. And Corrupt and Daz, they were like the Dog Pound, which is like, you know, one of the biggest groups off of Death Row.
Yeah, so we can, let's kind of go through side one a little bit as far as like the songs that stick out. So I guess I'll go first. Obviously, I mentioned Ambitions as a Rider, definitely just like a perfect open track, super catchy and everything, and just great pump up song. And I think overall disc one is pretty flawless.
It's very consistent.
Yeah. And I guess the only thing I would say is like, the songs are long, but, I feel like the beats themselves, like they make it worth it most of the time. You know?
Yeah. Like they never get boring in my opinion. Yeah.
And it keeps it fresh for sure. I'll say the big standout for me on side one is, Got My Mind Made Up. That one's super fun and, who we were talking about earlier, really solidified how much I love Method Man, who's got a great verse on that one.
Great rapper. What's sad with that track is that it was supposed to have one extra rapper on it, Inspector Deck, who you hear coming in at the end of it, like he's doing his ad-libs and stuff. INS the Rebel. But yeah, no one really knows why. They just cut, they kept his like opening and then just cut him off as if like it's already too fucking long. just cut it, you know.
But so there, what else on side one, which ones you want to talk about? Because I got a few more.
My favorite one on side one is Only God Could Judge Me. Because it's such an incredible like beat, that synth, that auto-tuned voice doing the song title. And I feel like some of Pac's like, because Pac is a rapper that like a lot of people like to critique because he could be repetitive at points. Like he loves nothing more than rhyming Hennessy with enemies throughout all of his albums. But you hear some of his like strongest verses on that song. And like I was talking earlier, like what I love about his album is that it gives you a lot of like exposure of like underrated rappers like Sebo. Rapping Forte is like such a dope underrated rapper from the West Coast who gets to like shine on this song, where that song is one I really like love especially.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I love that one too. And especially going from Life Goes On into that. You kind of have like the universal message of, you know, like attempting to overcome grief, and then right into just like paranoia, but like you just got shot multiple times, and
yeah,
that change obviously not physically changes you forever, but it also mentally changes you forever.
Yeah, it's not a healthy way to think, but it's like inspiring. Just like he's finding strength to carry on and not let it blind him too much, you know.
Right. And like the production on that one, it's that one stood out to me. Only God Can Judge Me as being like very modern in a way. Like Mm-hmm. And like you have that like sound of the flat line come in on like the left and the right, which I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Part of it. But yeah, like also No More Pain was one that stood out for me as a modern production sounding. And you had like the whispering along with the hook, which kind of like just made me think of 21 Savage with the whole whisper thing. That was kind of like a, I guess it was kind of like a funny thing that he like leaned into, but in the like the wobbly bass. So yeah, that one. I like that one a lot.
Yeah, no, those ones are great. I love my favorite hook on this side is probably Nate Dogg's Scandalous. Well, it's just because it showed his like talent as a singer that he could just literally, because he only sings that one word. He sings like maybe three words in that hook, but it's like so catchy, so fucking dope. Just amazing artist, gone too soon.
Yeah.
The California Love remix kind of like, it's fine. It's just, it sucks that because of the stuff I was talking about earlier of like Dre being mad about it not being a song anymore, they weren't given permission to put the original version on the album. Where the remix is cool. It has like a really cool Roger Troutman breakdown at the end that the original doesn't have. But it just doesn't, it doesn't bounce nearly as much as the original.
Yeah. Okay. So if you had a preference, you would say the original.
Oh yeah, definitely. All the way. I think the original is like one of the best pop songs ever. Like it's fucking incredible.
I mean, it is worth it to have, Roger Troutman going like, me, 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 me.
Yeah, no, I love that shit.
Shaking their booties. City of Compton, City of Compton, where the girls shake their booties. Shaking mama, shaking baby, shake, shaking baby.
Yeah, no, that shit is awesome. Where I know this, because a lot of people hate this version, but I'm like, he makes it work. Like, I love that dude so much, Roger Troutman. He's great.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the only other one that really stood out was like the beat on the last song on side one, What's Your Phone Number?
Yeah, yeah.
That one is just like very chaotic. And then like the whole ending part where it's like a skit of just like, you know, him talking to a lady and like talking about what they're going to do later and all that.
Yeah, you know, for the ladies, which fortunately, like, I don't know, 90s rap, because of like it having so much misogyny going on in there, being normalized, the songs for the ladies can even still be a bit like cringe to listen to, because like, I'm sure it worked in that time period. I'm sure it was very much what women listeners of rap wanted, but like growing up, you know, having like better teachings about gender and stuff, it's just like, yeah, it's a skip. You know, I don't need this, especially because I Ain't Mad At Ya is such an incredible song where I can't imagine how much stronger this one would be if it got to like end on that note.
That would have rounded things out if it was 13 songs, you know, lucky number 13 on side one has 13, side two. But he had to keep in What's Your Phone Number.
He really needed that phone number. Oh, wait, real quick. Okay. So what's your phone number? It's bad not because of it being a song for ladies. That's somewhat clever because I forgot another song. How Do You Want It is one of the coolest, like one of the dopest songs for ladies in 90s rap. Yeah. That song, I love the beat on that. Loved it since I first heard it. Great flowing, dope hook. Like Casey and JoJo is like such an incredible duo. But yeah.
Yeah, every beat on like that first thing, like it just keeps like changing up to something really well. Like the first listen was really awesome because it was all mostly fresh. And like, yeah, like this, like it just keeps kind of building up and changing it up in ways. Like, you know, he does kind of like, I guess, get a little redundant, but you know, what artist?
Yeah. Cause I don't know how much research you did on like the critics of this album, like the cultural critics, but do you know, see Dolores Tucker?
Yeah, I did look into that a little bit. I watched an interview with her and stuff. And
yeah, she's an interesting figure because, like I said, like her concerns are fair, but it ends for me where it's like you're blaming all of it on rap because it's all coming from somewhere. It's not just originating here. But like, I just think it's so funny that on a song that's generally just about like sex, he has time on to say, oh, how do you want it? Dolores Tucker, you a motherfucker. Like the way he says her line is just so funny. It's like, now, because like people younger than us don't know who the fuck Dolores Tucker is, but her name is not immortalized in that song. That really has nothing to really do with what she's mad about either. It's not a violent song at all.
Right. Yeah, no, and he mentions her twice on the album, and so that made me want to like look into, you know, her side of story. And again, like, you know, it's not like I'm saying she doesn't have any fair points, but it also seems like, well, she ended up suing him for like invasion of privacy among other things, I'm sure. But it's like because he like put her, like he talked about her on a song.
Yeah, he said her name.
Like, I'm sorry. Like if you can't handle the heat, you're gonna stay out of the kitchen. You know, you entered into this with Tupac Shakur. Like I imagine at the time, like people knew that this guy was going to be one of the biggest.
You I know, mean,
people.
It's a hot take, but it's a take that I'm always going to go with. Any outspoken cultural critic of transgressive forms of art are always grifters. They're always just in it for a check. Like, they have the morals. The morals are what going to make them seem good. But whenever they go for the lawsuit, whenever they go for, like, I want my bread, they're grifting. Because the classic one, of course, is Jack Thompson, who, speaking of San Andreas, his whole big thing was chasing ambulances for video games, saying, this kid shot this person because of Grand Theft Auto. You know, when it was rage, he just wanted to make money off of this thing that was, like, a huge phenomenon. Where Ben Shapiro loves hating on hip hop, but then he makes a fucking rap song.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where like it's just like it's all a grift. And Dolores Tucker, I respect definitely a lot more than Ben Shapiro. At the end of the day, motherfuckers are just trying to make their money.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't hate the game, but you can hate the player.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, so on the site too, you mentioned Can't See Me already, and that's another great opener. Mm-hmm. That's just a really cool song. And yeah, you can hear that overall influence on the entire album, in addition to the song that he appears on. So,
Yeah, that one's so sick. I really love a lot of the songs with like the Outlaws on it. Like Picture Me Rolling is such a like incredible vibe. I can listen to that beat like on loop for hours. And yeah. I love Big Psych. He's like one of the people who like I was talking about of just, like he was in Thug Life, but he kind of carried over to like the Outlaws. He's the guy with the really deep voice. He's like, I got keys from overseas. Yeah. Like,
yeah, yeah. He definitely stood out.
He's not at all like the best rapper in the world, but he's very much like if Rick Ross didn't exist and this guy existed in the 2000s, he would have Rick Ross's career. Like, yeah, he's such a great voice on a lot of Pac's albums.
But yeah, and he did the skit at the end of, I can't remember which song it was, but he's talking about like he was at the hotel. He's like, where's my drawers?
Yeah, checkout time. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that beat's real groovy too. Yeah. Where we're like, because what I love about like this two on here, while it's like definitely weaker and less well paced than disc one, it like has like a lot of like really groovy beats that keep you into it, you know? Like it doesn't like, it's definitely more boring, but it's not fully boring just because of how many of the beats like work on just, you know, getting into the vibe. It doesn't like slow you down or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like the first half of it, of side two.
The first half is definitely tough. Like, Can't See Me is a crazy intro, but yeah.
And it doesn't quite live up to that, which, you know, that's hard to do. But yeah, it does kind of take a redundant period. But then, yeah, like you said, once like the Outlaws start coming in and all the features towards the end of it, that's where it definitely picks back up.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I liked Run the Streets. There's just a line in there where he's like, he's kind of like just kind of talking. He's like, we can lay up in bed, watch Jay Leno or something. He's like talking about what he's going to do later with the girl or something. Like, yeah, watch Jay Leno and then have sex. Nothing like Jay Leno to get you in the mood.
Yeah, I love the hook on that one because that one at Thug Passion have just like a woman who is singing like her landlord's knocking on the door like she's singing. They're, like it's Joel, I think is how you say her name, but Joel two L's is how it's spelled. She does the hook on Thug Passion and Michelle A does the hook on Run the Streets. And both hooks are just them giving it all. Where those hooks make those songs for me. Especially Thug Passion, because she sounds like she's at the best party of her life doing that hook, man. Like, it's so good. You just gotta sing along to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, Run the Streets is no exception with that. Where, yeah, because I really do think that, like, the second half of this disc really is what saves it. Like, it's starting with Thug Passion, for me, it's pretty good from there on. Especially the title track. The title track is really good. Really strong.
Oh, yeah. All Eyes on Me,
Psych again. Mm-hmm. Deep voice Psych.
Yeah, the other one that, I think it's CPO. Picture Me Rolling, like again, like not like the best technical rapper, but he just kind of adds like this kind of like character, you know, like
he sounds just real smooth. He's like it's sort of like Snoop, but not necessarily. It's very of that vibe, you know.
Yeah, there's also I think Who is it that almost like has like Snoop Dogg's flow?
Mm-hmm.
It's probably on one of the ones with the Outlaws.
Yeah, because there's a lot of guys who are just, I won't say biting, but they very much was like, I mean, Snoop was like the biggest rapper, if not Pac, around.
I mean, yeah.
But yeah, but there's a lot of guys who are similar.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard not to kind of like, because the sound of it, it is so synonymous with like, you know, like the big names like Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg. Mm. So it's hard not to hear like these beats and not kind of just fall into that.
Yeah.
So
it's just great hearing you, you know, get so much out of it. Cause I did feel bad throwing a double album at you.
Yeah.
Where it's good to hear that you still got something out of it. Cause I wasn't thinking that at all. I just saw Sentimental Album and I was just like, well, this is an album that I think about all the time. Like I thought about the most. But it's grand, you know, it's a big.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, and yeah, Tupac's personality, it reflects that, you know, he's got a big personality and, yeah, there's a lot. Yeah. Again, like, I wouldn't say it's perfect, but I wouldn't say most double albums are perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
the best double albums are ones that are just double albums by circumstance. Like when it comes to mind for me is Speaker Box and Love Below.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're not, it's not really a double album, it's just two solo albums like sold combined, together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of has that like element of like just kind of making it separate.
Yeah.
Where a lot of double albums are just kind of the same stuff over and over. Mm-hmm. And I think the rare one where it worked for me, which was surprising, was actually Bruce Springsteen's The River, which,
oh yeah.
I don't know if you know much about Bruce Springsteen. I've recently gotten into him, but it's a very like, all the songs are very similar and they're very much like rock and roll, but mm-hmm. somehow they're just like keep being good. And it's like, dang, this one's good. No, this one's good. And I kept expecting, no, one of them's going to be a dud, but no, somehow he like was able to do it. Except maybe the one song, which I think gets a pass because it is cheesy, is like the song that it stuck in my head, like I'm a rocker, baby, I'm a rocker.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, enough about Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, no, and she's definitely something I want to get more into where I didn't know he had like a double album even.
Yeah, he's I went through all of his albums and there might be a couple I throw out for you to see if you're into it, because he definitely changed his style a lot over the years. But
oh yeah.
So yeah, any other last thoughts on All Eyes on Me?
Yeah, not to really, where I definitely like, I'm glad we got to talk about the controversial aspects of it, because the thing mm-hmm. is with like a lot of like discussion of 90s rap, people either want to just skate over it or just want to like throw it away because of it, where like Tupac as a person, Tupac isn't a hero. He's not a martyr. He's a human, a complex human. And I feel like this album encapsulates that complexity of just like, there are a lot of wise moments in it. There's a lot of moments that are like rooted in ignorance, but these things are all the things that made him up as like the figure that made him stand out in such a chaotic lane for rap. Cause there were some like, you know, there's a lot of rappers now. In the 90s, there were too many and too many good ones, not just like mm-hmm. rappers, like too many great rappers, you know, in the 90s where mm-hmm. it really just like shows why the hell he stood out for the way he did, where it's a hell of an album if you're trying to check out a double album. But if you're not trying to check out a double album, you can always do Me Against the World or Don Quixote if you try to get into Pac. Those two albums are short. They're shorter and they're still full of like great songs. You know, you're not missing out on getting why he was considered one of the greats.
Yeah, I think he'd definitely be a good one to check out the greatest hits if you want a sampling.
Oh yeah, that too. His greatest hits isn't bad at all. It's not like just the hits. They have like, intriguingly, a lot of album tracks on there, which I like deep cuts, I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. And yeah, like I think that's the thing, like, you know, regardless of what you feel about the person, like what we're trying to get out of it is the seeing the human. And that's even more interesting to do when you have someone like Tupac, who's really, you know, kind of putting on this character that, you know, probably really based on how he actually is. But he's also like he's trying to make people mad and also laugh at you while you're getting mad. So
yeah, no. And like an immediate parallel off of that is Kanye, who Kanye's biggest problem is he's not dead. So like we have to see where the hell Tupac would have gone if he wasn't gunned down in LA. Well, Vegas. I think he died in Vegas.
Yeah, I mean that's the tragedy, obviously.
Yeah, but like the immediate parallel is that of just like a guy who very much was playing a character to like get people into the music, and then he's, due to the fame, due to the stress of it all, became that, and it shows in the music, you know?
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing.
Yeah, and he definitely is a figure that means a lot to people. So that's part of unpacking it, too, is, like, why, like, especially for me, who's not in on all, I don't know the whole story, and like I didn't listen to him as a kid or anything, but like, why is this guy mean so much to people, to where people like are constantly painting him and all these like pictures and stuff like that, and memes and
tattoos,
whatever. yeah
so. Documentaries, he has like almost over 20 fake albums that came out since he died.
Yeah,
more than Jimi Hendrix.
I mean we didn't even mention the infamous Tupac hologram. To me, like, not knowing anything about Tupac, it's like an easy to just write off as like a weird thing, but like people like wanted that to happen, I guess.
And you see it just like how much the genre rap still loves him. Like, even rappers as young as Playboi Carti bring him up, you know, where he's very much a timeless figure, and this album gives you a good understanding of why.
And I'll say too, listening to this album, like, it made me want to go listen to more rap too, and it got me excited, like, about rap. You know, like if I it's not like I lost it or whatever, but it just really made me excited about it.
Oh yeah.
So I think it's great for that reason. And going back to what you said on the intro episode about how rap is made by people that love music, you know, this is a perfect example of that.
Oh yeah.
So mandatory my elevation, my lyrics like orientation, so you could be more familiar with the nigga you facing. We must be patient, nothing better than communication. Known the damage and highly flammable like gas stations. Sorry I left that ass waiting. No more procrastination, give up the fate and get that ass shaking.
All right, so now let's switch gears to the album that I picked, The Redheaded Stranger by Willie Nelson, which, you know, of course, I've talked about Willie Nelson a lot already in our few episodes that we've put out. But this album for me was immediately one that just became like an addictive listen. Like, it would just play on almost, I would almost have it on a loop when I first got into it. And even more than that, I would say an amateur guitar player. And these songs were like, I was obsessed with learning how to play them, and just how the sounds that Willie makes on his guitar on this, just, yeah, they just completely took over my mind and my interest. And you know, it was just addicting to listen to for a lot of reasons, which we'll get into. But we'll start by Julius. You know, you were new to this album, right? So how did you react to it when you first heard it?
I was so just like tranced. Like, I was put in a trance from listening to this, just because it has like one of my favorite things about that I find on a lot of older albums, especially albums that, you know, have reprises of earlier songs and stuff, where it's not that every song sounds the same or sounds similar, but they have like such motifs going on instrumentally where it feels like you're listening to like one giant track. Where first time I listened to it, I was just sitting in my chair high as shit and just like, not even noticing when a song was going to another one. I was just like, man, this is a great ass song. And I look at my phone, I'm like, wait, when did this song become Hands on the Wheel? You know, from like the beginning, where it's like a very like easy listening, and not easy like a baby can figure out its themes and stuff. There's a lot of complex things going on in the lyric system of this album. But like the like soundscape that Willie Nelson, his like band that he's working with on this album, it really makes just like something that's like real easy to put on and just like tune into. Like, it's not like because for me, I'm someone who definitely listens to like a lot of like loud fucking scraping your ears type music. Like, I'm very much into noise, where as much as I love that stuff, it definitely makes like stuff harder to like get into and take in, where there'll be like lyrics I won't catch until like a year later. Whereas with Redheaded Stranger, it was just kind of a relief to just be able to, like, you know, dive into something. It felt like I was sitting on a cloud, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah. And I never heard a Willie Nelson album before this. I definitely have heard his music. I wouldn't be able to name anything, but I wouldn't be surprised if I've heard some of his music before this. And it's such a, it really gives everything that I was looking forward to checking out with him. And I fully think I get why he's considered one of the greats, just off of like how phenomenal all this album is. I'll stop. But there's one thing that I want to bring up that just makes me laugh, is that when I looked at the cover, I just kept thinking, like, this looks like the Chronic.
Oh, my God.
The Chronic album cover. Because they have like the same round white background thing. They have a total different like structure. But it's just funny to look at it, because I know Willie Nelson ended up doing music with Snoop Dogg. But it was just an immediate connection I made when I first like checked it out, which is just a cool cover, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is a cool cover. And I know, like, Okay, well, hold on. Let me, before I get ahead of myself too much, let's give...
Yeah, because I dropped a lot on you. Sorry.
Yeah, no. gosh, I could probably talk about this, just this album as a whole podcast, you know? Mm-hmm. It's one of those
things.
Yeah, no. So it came out in 1975. It was the first release for Columbia. So Willie was on RCA first and tried to get big, and just nobody was getting it, what the albums were selling. Then he gets picked up by Atlantic and drops two absolute classic albums, Shotgun Willie and Phases and Stages, which is another concept album. So keep in mind, this album's a concept album. It's not his first. It's not his second. It's either third or fourth, depending on who you ask.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing for me is that it's the first time he produces his own album.
Yeah.
So this is the first step on just him exposing himself to the world, you know, for the lack of a better term, he's putting it all out there.
It's funny in that phrase. Cause isn't he doesn't he do nude shows?
Nude?
I don't know if I'm mistaken with another artist, but
yeah, no, I never heard of that.
Never. Okay. I'm mostly thinking of a different artist thing. Cause I'm who the fuck be performing shows nude?
The Red Hot Chili Peppers, I'm pretty sure, have done it multiple times. But yeah, no, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's not Willie. I looked up nude Willie and I got a bunch of different things.
A little bit more background on how this came to be is that, you know, Atlantic, you know, he got close with Jerry Wexler of Atlantic, who's one of the, I guess, producers or, you know, executives there. And he very much was encouraging him to kind of, you know, have the creative control, which is part of his issues before with RCA. He had to basically just follow their rules of, you know, mm-hmm. putting all these strings and stuff and producing it a certain way.
So it was a lot of technical things they were looking from him rather than stuff that he was singing about.
Yeah, and they just, all the songs they put out, they had to be recorded in their style of, you know, the Nashville sound is what they call it, where it's all these, you know, background vocals and syrupy, you know, string sections and stuff. And don't get me wrong, I love a lot of the RCA stuff. There's a lot of good stuff on there, and some of his best songs were recorded for those sessions, and they're so good, in fact, that he would go record the different versions of them later on and put, you know, any given Willie song has probably been recorded 3 or 4 times, depending on how much he personally likes it. Sometimes mm-hmm. even more than that.
Yeah.
You include live version stuff, obviously. But yeah, so this album, he was basically given this huge budget of I don't know what the exact number is. I think it's probably disputed, but $60,000, say. And he spent only $2,000 of it to record this album. The rest of the money he used to just buy new equipment for the band and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, when he turns this album in, the executives, they thought it was a demo, and he was no, this is the album. This, you know, he recorded it exactly the way you hear it now. They didn't add anything after the fact because his contract allowed him full creative control.
Which is cool. It's cool to hear that because, I mean, listening to this in 2024, that wasn't at all what I thought listening to it. Thinking, is it a demo? Which, of mm-hmm. course, music executives somehow have the craziest ears of any human being, which,
yeah.
I don't know, I like to imagine that them, and as in them, their assistants, have to listen to so much music where your taste is just going to be thrown off regardless. But, just interesting hearing this, restrained style being dismissed as, a demo, because I guess, because what year did this come out again? 1975, you said?
Yeah, 75.
I guess that was around a time when, it was very much, very grandiose, where it's kind of interesting to hear that even artists of that region Willie Nelson were being put on that kind of standard.
Yeah, and again, this is the early stages of him breaking out. He was barely loved in Texas and stuff like that, but nationally he wasn't the Willie Nelson that we know now yet. You know, this is kind mm-hmm. of what actually put him there, because you know, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain was a big hit. People loved it. So yeah, this album definitely set him on the course to become, you know, one of the biggest country artists.
As John Lennon says in Dewey Cox, great record.
Great record. I love that line. Still haven't seen that movie, but anyway.
Oh man, that scene is, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Great film. Okay, I'll stop. Oh, yeah. Okay. So I was going to say, yeah, like at the time, I'll give you, I actually did this weird experiment where I found all the number one country songs in the 70s and put them on a playlist and just to kind of like shuffle through just to kind of hear what was going on. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of good stuff that has that Nashville sound. And there's also a lot of different stuff that makes it through to the top. But yeah. In particular, like if you've ever heard of Billy Sherrill, he's a big producer that pretty much mastered the Nashville sound, you know, among others, of course. Like he wasn't the first, but he took what they did and kind of expanded it further. George Jones is what, and Tammy Wynette were his big artists. But
have you? This is very much off topic, but it's just like it's in my mind. Have you seen the film Nashville?
I haven't. I've wanted to, though.
Yeah, it's like, because that's what I'm thinking of when you're talking about Nashville. It's like a place where this kind of music's coming from.
Yeah, that's. I'm sure that's a good picture of
yeah.
it.
Yeah, because like it's generally just about like that era of country music.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, like Billy Sherrill is one of the ones that specifically like didn't like this album when he heard it because, yeah, like mm-hmm. you said, his taste is very skewed because the Nashville way of doing things was very efficient, let's say. Like they mm-hmm. record four songs in a day and, you know, like they would just do the take and like the session players are all great. They're extreme professionals. But again, when you record that way, you're doing so much that like it does become this weird, it's work, you know, it's like a process and there's a lot of magic that comes out of it, but there's also a lot of duds, you know, like kind of boring stuff. So yeah. it's just one of those things. And, you know, people like don't really like the, or like people like trash the kind of that way of doing it. And again, there's fair criticisms to be had, but it's definitely produced some good stuff that, you know, it's not worth dismissing.
There's never been a great era of music where it was fully like the record industry or fully independent, I would say. Yeah. Like there's always been like good stuff coming from either side of the spectrum.
Or where it's all good. Some of like there's going to be some things that are bad that come through, you know.
Yeah, cuz like I mean to take it to like a completely different way of it, like music and rap that usually like, you know, is all about boasting of like, oh, we're not endorsed by the record industry. You won't hear any pop singles here. You won't hear any singers on our track. And it's just like, well, yeah, but like it doesn't have to be that where right. it becomes kind of an issue. I feel like when both things are too aware of each other and they're trying to like make it into a competition rather than being like, this is where you made your work. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of like I will say, I probably should have said this earlier, but like, if you haven't heard this album, I really recommend experiencing it without knowing the story ahead of time. Cause we're not going to get too into it, but we will talk about, cause like I mentioned, it's a concept album. It tells a story that the story itself is pretty cut and dry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're able to find the basic pieces of it without paying too closely attention. The real magic is when you start to pay closer attention and see how everything fits in. So yeah, I'll say if you haven't listened to it, I really recommend you stop now, go check it out. It's only a 33 minute album, you know. Part of the really interesting thing to me is, you know, Willie Nelson, I think he's a lot of things, but definitely at the top, he's an incredible writer. But
absolutely,
he only wrote what, like a couple songs on this album?
Yeah, like my favorite song on album, which I'll get into more as we talk more about favorites, is Hands on the Wheel. Mm-hmm. And I was like surprised to see it wasn't him just because he
owns
the fuck out of the story on there, you know?
Yeah.
Which like, you know, it's just a further realization that like it doesn't really matter how the sausage is made, you know? Because, mm-hmm. like, more than ever, since everyone's trying to, like, be like, I'm self-made, I got no team, I got no one working with me, you mm-hmm. can pull things off with the help of other talented artists. Like, the singer doesn't have to be the songwriter, and the singer doesn't need to be the one making everything. Because I'm sure he had a very talented band working with him on this album as well, which I haven't looked into. That's why I'm just saying band, because I don't know who was involved yet.
Yeah, it's for the most part, like, the band that he wanted to tour with.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into the specific members in a little bit. But yeah, like, so just to go kind of go through, he wrote Time of the Preacher, which appears three times throughout the first side. And then he wrote...
I did the same thing with history essays.
Yeah. Blue Rock Montana, which is like a half of a song, which actually Blue Rock No, sorry, actually Denver. He wrote Denver, which is the first song on side two, and then the instrumental at the end, Bandera. And Denver was actually kind of the first song that got the ball rolling with the concept. Like, I think it was like, the story is he literally driving into Denver and saw the bright lights, and he wrote, "The bright lights of Denver are shining like diamonds." Okay, so...
Which I'm just glad that I love Denver. Denver's like one of my favorite places I've had the chance to visit. Well, I'm just glad it has a really cool song attached to it.
Yeah. So is there any general thoughts you want to get into before we kind of like go through it?
Yeah. Like, I guess I definitely want to get to talking a bit of how it relates to the prompt where. Just because I don't know if you got to there's a talking about it. Like, is this like your favorite Willie Nelson album? Was it the first one you heard? Was it the first one you heard that like made you a fan? Like, why this one for your sentimental album?
Yeah, I think it was the first one that like made me obsessed, I think is the best way to put it. Like, because if it's not clear already, I'm pretty obsessed. Like,
which is perfectly fine. Everyone has an artist they should be obsessed with. Like, just don't send death threats to people.
So
don't be mean about Willie.
Yeah, he's never done anything wrong, okay? but, yeah, so, like, yeah, this is the one that, it's hard to remember exactly the order in which I kind of got into it. But, yeah, like I said, it was the one that I played over and over again. I tried to recreate all the guitar parts and everything. It got me playing my acoustic guitar more than anything else, I would say.
Oh, yeah, how old were you when this was happening?
This was pretty recently. This was... after college, this was probably 2019, 2020.
Nice.
So I was, I was in my 20s at that point, mid 20s.
Oh yeah. And I think it's cool to like, I feel like a lot of people, especially with like my pick, cause All Eyes on Me, it was like an album I heard when I was like as young as like fucking 5 or 6 even, which I definitely understand it, but it's just like, it was always there because of how much my dad was into it, where it's cool to hear that you have picked something that's like from your early adulthood, you know?
Yeah.
Because I feel like, especially one that led to like, having like such a huge connection with artists like this, because I feel like, especially with most music listeners, we stick to the like first artist we really got to when we were younger, and that stays the like big favorite. Where it's cool to hear that this is like a later development, because me and Danny were close friends in college, but I definitely don't think I got to like hear much about Willie Nelson back then, where this makes sense, like the timing of it.
I knew nothing, even in as late as me being in college. I didn't really know much about him. Like, like I remember like someone I did listen to at the time, like someone compared their voice to Willie, and I was like, oh yeah, but I didn't really know Willie at all.
Because culturally we don't really have much things. Like for us who aren't, living in the South, I know Danny does, but like for me especially, we don't have that much things culturally telling us, yo, go check out Willie Nelson, go dive into his body of work. And because I got to Google this because I already embarrassed myself over like nude Willie Nelson. I got to confirm if he was in Austin Powers because that's the first time I really remember seeing him in something.
He was.
Yeah, he's in Austin Powers.
It was like the joke where it's like, look at that giant Willie. And then it's like someone talking to Willie. Yeah.
But yeah, I know. But like outside of that, I didn't really know too much about him besides the weird crossovers he would have. Like I mentioned earlier, he has a song with Snoop Dogg.
And all the memes, of course.
Yeah. Where it's cool to like, look behind the meme, look behind what he stands for culturally and see that there is like an amazing musician here that, deserves all of this like love and like, portrayal and culture.
Right. And in my Willie studies, if you will, like I listen to a podcast called One by Willie, and like pretty much the theme is everyone loves Willie because like they just heard him around. Like, so they, lived at a time where either like their parents had Willie records, like, Stardust is like a big one that probably most people of that era had because it was so popular. And then like, hearing him on the radio, like, a lot of it is like people that are like grew up listening to country. You're more likely a big Willie fan than if you never did. Because I didn't grow up listening to country at all. I came to that later in life and have kind of gone back through the history of it. In all the eras and stuff. As a kid, I was raised on more rock stuff and punk rock stuff. And I mean, not that I'm a punk rock or anything. Like, I'm not trying to say that, but like, Ramones was a kid, stuff I listened to as a kid.
People are going to say, yeah, you're punk. Where's the video cast? I want to see your tats. I don't know what I'm doing.
I'm a punk rock gatekeeper. Yeah, you're not allowed to listen to punk rock because I like it more than you.
I fucking love Green Day.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so it just like, yeah, my kind of thing. And it shows you like that, like if you really dig into something, it's more than just the meme of it, you know, like, yeah, yes, he likes to smoke weed and all that. But there's so much to find. And there's probably tons of artists out there where like you might think of them as a joke. But if you really dug in, you'll find that, you know, like, whoa, like this is actually really good. So yeah, like yeah, this I don't know, I can't say it's my favorite, you know, that's like it's really hard to pick, but it's definitely why I picked it for sentimental, like above all other Willie Nelson albums. I picked this one for sentimental favorites because it was that addicting thing that became the soundtrack of, like, you know, I remember taking a trip to Virginia, like the Blue Ridge Mountains and stuff, and that like all these songs were on a playlist and they came on a lot and yeah, it's just kind of like the starting point, like, oh my God, like, what is this guy doing? You know, I got to hear more of it.
I'm excited to listen to his music as I travel more. Like, I want to take a long Amtrak train and put on some Willie Nelson.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, God, there's tons of stuff, and he's still putting out stuff, which is crazy.
Yeah,
to me. Like,
which is, that's just inspiring, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And writing songs over text message. Yeah.
But is it good?
Oh, is it good? Yeah, I would say a lot of it's very good, you know.
Oh, yeah. That was more me joking, but yeah. I'm glad to hear that's good, at least.
Yeah. I mean, like, they're like, you put out like two albums a year, and one of them will be like a tribute album, which, you know, it's not earth shattering or anything like that.
Yeah.
But it's just great to hear them, you know, like enjoying, you know, making music. So it's good for that reason.
It's awesome when artists can just reach that point and just still want to work, because I feel like big thing that artists want to be in control of is their narrative, their legacy. So they like rid themselves as a like artist to the world, because they're so obsessed with like, I want my work to be perceived on my own terms and stuff. And it just results in them like just not releasing shit, where I respect, like, you know, Jay-Z and like Frank Ocean, those types of like not wanting to release music much. But it definitely, like, you know, it makes me like wonder like how much, I just get really intrigued when an artist chooses to like stop doing that. Like just being like, I dropped all I wanted. I'm not retired, but I'm basically retired. Where enjoy the shit that I do have currently. Because to me, like, it's great when you're able to get to a point like Willie Nelson, or even like, since I reference like rappers, like a rapper who I'm always excited to see still dropping stuff is this guy from Bay Area, E-40, who is just one of the greats. If you never checked out Bay Area rap, E-40 is like a great gateway to some amazing music. And he's still dropping stuff to this day, like triple albums, like triple disc albums. Wow. Yeah, no, he's like old, but he still has it. No one else raps like him. He's great. And like, you know, for me, that just like is inspiring to see, because for them, it's like not about like being controlled or narrative or like needing to make money or whatever. It's just they love to do this shit and they love sharing it with the people, which is like one of my favorite parts of music is this mutual love for this medium.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, they get more obsessed with the story of it all rather than just the art of it. Which, guys like Frank Ocean, I get wider in that case. Jay-Z, I just think it's pretentious just to give some, like, range on my take for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, like, I think as far as, like, having something to say, Willie's probably past that point. But, you know, every now and then something kind of comes through that's, like, extra special, like, as far as his new stuff. Like, his album... that was released in 2022. It's called The Beautiful Time. And it's a mixture of songs that he wrote and songs that, you know, he picked from other people. But there's some incredible stuff on there, like Energy Follows Thought. He named a book after that song, like just kind of like laying out his philosophy of like, you know, not getting too caught up in the future or the past and just kind of living in the moment, and the power of your thoughts being, you know, like controlling your life. If you allow your thoughts to overtake you in a negative way, then, like, you know, you said it better in the song type of thing. But like, it's just a really special song to hear, like, him still put out stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Amongst all the other stuff where it's just good, clean fun and stuff he's passionate about, like paying tribute to Frank Sinatra, who he took a lot of pages from as far as his singing. And also like our songwriters like Harlan Howard, who wrote some classic country songs that he wants to make sure his name is out there and stuff like that. So
The Sinatra thing is cool to hear, because I feel like I could definitely hear the parallels of just like knowing how to create melodies and instrumentation with his vocals. Like there's There's just a lot of great moments on this album that has things like that going for it. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the, I think the big one that everyone talks about too, like, again, like people talk about his songwriting, his guitar playing. That's one of my personal, obviously, favorite things about him is, you know, listening to him play guitar. And but yeah, his phrasing and stuff, like it's almost a joke that like singing along with Willie is like one of the hardest things ever, because he is so behind the beat or in front of the beat, but it works. And to me, like, he's singing around his guitar playing, like he'll sing really quickly so he can play a hot lick right after, you know, that type of thing. So all right, let's kind of get into the album. We'll start with the first side, and you know, I mentioned spoilers are coming about the story, so. The first side, it opens with Time of the Preacher, and that's the repeating motif. You have this preacher character. He realizes that his wife is fooling around with someone else, and she left him. And that devastation is what sets off the events of the story. So he finds that out, and one of the best lines maybe ever of Willie's songwriting is
he cried like a baby, he screamed like a panther in the middle of the night.
And he cried like a baby. He screamed like a panther in the middle of the night. And as soon as like he says that, you hear Mickey Raphael, the harmonica player, just like kind of wail out a harmonica note to kind of accent that and, you know, set the scene.
That's good to know, because I had a note about the wah-wah sound. And I had no idea that was a harmonica, so that makes a lot of sense. I don't know why. I don't know why I forgot harmonicas exist when listening to this album.
Yeah, yeah. There's harmonica, and there's also like this other instrument that it's not listed on the credits or whatever, but it's like a boing kind of thing. I wish I knew the name of it.
There's a lot of cool sounds on this album. Basically what I'm going to get to.
Like the percussion too. That first song, Time of the Preacher, is there's like a brush, like, and then like a tambourine shake, like almost like you could picture like someone sweeping an old wooden, you know, porch, and then like the bells ringing when you open up the door to a shop or something like that.
Yeah.
So like they use it very sparingly. That was the whole intention, was to be very, very spare and sparse. But the stuff that does come through adds to the cinema of it. Oh, and what I was going to mention earlier is that the album artwork itself, I don't actually own a copy of it physically, but I've seen pictures of, it's basically a storyboard for a movie.
Oh, really?
And of course, yeah, and they turned out, they did end up making a movie called Redheaded Stranger based on it. I haven't seen it, but I think it was more of just like an excuse for all Willie and his friends to get together and have fun on a movie set and just mess around.
We need more of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun, right? Because it's kind of like the pop star movie,
yeah,
right?
Because some people are like, that's such a waste of time and money. I'm like, there's already too many movies in this fucking world. Let a musician fuck around and make a film.
Yeah, let it go. Yeah.
But I'm glad you brought up that line of he cried like a baby and screamed like a panther, because it immediately stood out to me just like how much I love the songwriting of this thing, because it's very emotive. It's very omniscient. I don't know if I said that right, but it's just like very, because like it's coming from like an all-knowing being, this perspective that he brings to these stories and stuff. And that he cried like a baby, he screamed like a panther. I feel like it, very simple word choice, very straightforward, but it gives such a crazy range of how fucked this preacher is, you know, from what he's just experienced. Because he wrote this one, right?
Yes.
Yeah, this one's good. All the other ones suck because he didn't write them. But, you know, you should make 10 more of these.
Sell out. He's
no
lazy.
Wonder he did this two more times throughout the album. But yeah, no, this is like such a sick intro that goes by so quick, where I don't know what it is, like songs that are shorter than 3 minutes before this century are way quicker than songs like that today, where I remember just like constantly going back to it, despite it has those other versions. Despite, personally, my favorite one is the... Oh yeah, my favorite Time of the Preacher is like the one right before Just As I Am, just because of how crazy it is to hear it transition to that song.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Where I'm just
it's 26 seconds.
Yeah, because I just think it's cool that, you know, like, once again, this isn't like a thing that only he did. Like, other albums in this era had reprises and refrains and stuff, but it's just really cool to see it work out here, which is another thing I wish that like more music today would like bring back. It's just a sequencing. Because, you know, it definitely saves time for the artists. Because I know a lot of artists have a hard time making songs now.
Right, right. Yeah, and then, you know, it goes into, like, as far as the story, goes into, like, the fact that the preacher goes crazy and kills his lover. Mm-hmm. And her, or he kills his wife and her lover, rather. You know, from there, makes a run for it, basically. Goes off to Blue Rock, Montana. Then kills another person who tried to steal his horse. And again, it's funny because Redheaded Stranger, he didn't write. It became his nickname, you know, Willie's the Redheaded Stranger.
Was his hair red?
I mean, it's like that strawberry blonde, mm-hmm. I think, not like orange. Like,
okay, that makes sense.
So that's, it fits. But Redheaded Stranger was a song that he like sang to his kids as a lullaby, which it's teased as he's on the run in the Blue Rock, Montana song. Mm-hmm.
Which, like, I think Redheaded Stranger just knocks so much. That's my word for it. Like, it knocks. Like, that hook is just so fucking dope.
Yeah, don't cross him, don't boss him. He's wild in his song.
Yeah, nah. It's so fucking fire.
Don't cross this guy. He's too emotional that he's going to kill.
Yeah, people. It's like, it's more just funny to hear this kind of violence and this kind of like very delicate and like calming music. Because like you just said, this guy was singing as a lullaby to his kids. Because was there like any like in your research of like this album or whatever you read about it, was there ever any controversy of like these songs being about such violent characters?
No, I don't think so. I think for some reason they were fine with it, but then as soon as like
as soon as black people started,
as soon as Ghetto Boys came out, they're like, whoa,
the fuck.
No, because but the crazy thing too is like, you know, kind of spoiling the end, it goes into an arc of redemption, mm-hmm. which, you know, like, you know, regardless of, you know, whatever you think like about you know, obviously killing, we don't need to tell you that killing's bad, but to live in a mindset where you can have forgiveness it's very powerful.
You know? Absolutely.
Even for the most extreme of actions like that. Mm-hmm. And I'll just leave it at that, you know? And it goes into Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain. Like I mentioned, was one of the bigger hits.
Yeah.
Like the biggest hit from this
which
album.
Which makes sense.
What do you think about that song?
I wasn't sure. Cause I like I said, I didn't look up anything cause I wanted to like learn it from you. But, like, I didn't think that was going to be the hit of it. I would have thought of it something as tender as Can I Sleep in Your Arms? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Blue Eyes, that makes a lot of sense. It's very catchy.
Yeah. It's definitely up there in the as far as the all-time great Willie songs. Mm-hmm. And I think it stands alone as well, whereas maybe the other songs stand better in the context of the album.
Mm-hmm. Where it's cool to, like, see an album like this have a concept going for it and still being able to like fit in covers to like tell its story. Yeah.
I mean, the covers are the crux of the story, mm-hmm. really. And he kind of just writes around to kind of put them all together.
Yeah.
To glue them together, I guess.
Which is kind of like a thing that some liberals don't like called sampling. Willie should pay the people who originally wrote these songs. He should start writing his own stuff.
Yeah.
He should get a real name. Why is he not called William Nelson? But yeah, no, Blue Eyes is sick.
So we can kind of take a detour here and talk about the instrumental songs.
Yeah.
Did you have any specific thoughts about those? Because there's a few of them.
Yeah, I really fucking love Bandera, especially. Because like, mm-hmm. well, it's really just good to, because like it's a very tender outro that like, I try to figure out how to really find the words for it, but I just really love that one, especially because it feels like it's very much a encapsulation of what the sound has been building towards as putting it to sleep. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Where all the elements are there and they're kind of peaking, where that's probably like my second favorite song in the album. And I love that like this album has room for instrumentals because it definitely helps it have like a way more like circular structure of just having these like transitions that feel like it's this the stranger traveling, you know, on this journey.
Yeah. Like you said that about it's very circular. It just kind of it's kind of spins around in mm-hmm. a way to kind of use the line about from Hands on the Wheel, like, you know, the world seems to be spinning.
Yeah.
You know? I really like the instrumentals, particularly like they're all good. I don't know what I'm talking about. They're all good.
There's not one where I was like, hey, Willie, you should have gotten the booth for this.
Yeah. I'll just talk about all of them. That Just As I Am, which it's a hymn, mm-hmm. which typically is sung with words.
Yeah.
And if you look at the words of the song, it's basically saying like, you know, talking about how God, you know, will accept you just as you are. Mm-hmm. It's right in the title, right? Like, and it fits so perfectly, like God, you know, to, you know, I'm not very religious, but to think about God accepting you just as you are, even though you've just killed three people, you know, it really is powerful. And, mm-hmm. and again, taking the words away is such a good choice, yeah. because it just hammers that it's the feeling of it that you need, mm-hmm. right? You don't need to be told, even though I'm going to step in and tell you what this album means, you know, but yeah, like just that even if you have this insanely dark spot on your soul, that you can still find a path to redemption.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's one of many, many gospel songs that Willie's done. And he does a lot of them with his sister, Bobby Nelson, who passed away a few years ago.
Rest in peace.
But yeah, her playing is just so beautiful. And that takes me into Down Yonder, which is on the second side. Mm-hmm. And so basically you have the song Denver setting the scene. This guy, he's on the run and on a path to redemption. He goes into a bar. And the thing I love most about this album is how it connects the moment that he kills his wife and her lover as they're dancing with smiles on their faces. He connects that to him later on in a bar with a new lover, and they're dancing with smiles on their faces, which is how it leads from Denver into Over the Waves, which is a waltz. And then it kicks into Down Yonder, which is like an old honky-tonk piano, which it became a staple in the Willie Live show.
Yeah.
Where he would introduce his sister, Bobby. Like, this is my... He called her little sister, Bobby, even though that she was a couple years older. But he's like, everyone, this is my little sister, Bobby. Let's hear a little Down Yonder. And then she would go into it, playing it, you know, and each time it repeats, she goes a little faster and a little higher pitched. Mm. So that's a really special song.
Oh, yeah. That song is fucking awesome.
Thank you all very much. This is our little sister, Bobby, playing the piano for you today. She would like to play Down Yonder.
The more dancing joints on here makes me wish that Chicago had clubs that played this kind of music.
Yeah.
I don't think the word is club, but I also don't want to say the word that I think it is. Hold down?
A honky tonk?
Hoot nanny?
I think of honky tonk.
We lost our listeners from the South.
we're both Yankees, you know.
We would both die in our blue suits if we were born in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But yeah, no, it's just like really... This album really has it all, you know, very emotive storytelling, incredible, like, narrative of just, like, because something I want to talk about just with Denver that really, like, fascinated me, especially just with this guy who, like, you know, just committed these murders, and now he's, like, in this, like, tavern dancing, and he finds, like, redemption further and stuff. I don't want to guess the setting or time period this all happened, but, you know, you kind of just assume it must be, like, times before the law was an organized institution. Where it's fascinating mm-hmm. that a guy who's made these like terrible decisions has to live with his guilt, where his own mind is like his own prison in a way. And through his own journey, he has to like find that redemption and earn it, rather than just being, he did this shit, he doesn't have to fucking think about it, now he's dancing with this lady, you know? Where Denver feels like a very like, you know, like it's not falling action, but it's like, you know, it's going upwards for his character, but deservingly, rather than like, you know, just... Because Willie Nelson wanted to throw on a fucking lighthearted track, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and the fact that he does bring up the, you know, makes that connection of the smiles on their faces as they're dancing, it does show that he is thinking mm-hmm. about it. Like, it's not going to leave
him. Not at
him.
All. It's a part of him, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then, like, you have the song Can I Sleep in Your Arms? That is, like, him, like, resorting, like, I need someone to help me do mm-hmm. this, too. Which is also very powerful.
Beautiful song. I'm glad I didn't know it when I was 16 because I would post the lyrics on my Tumblr.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would have too if I had this back then. I never had a Tumblr.
Yeah. But yeah, no, like it's a very, very beautiful song that encourages you to like, you know, throw yourself into of relating to it where it just, it leaves me speechless. Cause for me, I love nothing more than a very sad, like, it's not like it's a love song, but it's very much like the motherfucker's begging. Cause like he's at his wit's end, you know, where that kind of like vibe, it always leaves me speechless because I just feel like the song itself can really do its work for the person talking about it. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good one to listen to closely. Can I Sleep in Your Arms? Because, if you have a good pair of headphones on, you can hear like the reverb in his voice just ringing out in a very tasteful way, I'll say.
Yeah.
It almost sounds like natural reverb. I don't know if it is or not, but just kind of like echoing that, like accepting of the, you're like, I'm all alone, but I need someone to help me through.
And also I noticed like, cause like the album starts off with some pretty short songs. Like the second song I think is like even shorter than the first one from what I remember, where I couldn't believe it was true, which not a good song. The album's full of great songs. Why am I even saying it? But but Can't Sleep in Your Arms.
That's a thumper.
Yeah. Wait, what?
It's a thumper, like you want to just, you know, stomp along.
Yeah. With
it, even though it's like, I can't believe my wife left me.
The divorce playlist is slapping tonight.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah, yeah.
But like Can't Sleep in Your Arms is like it's totals at like, you know, 5 minutes 24 seconds, which is pretty long for like on this album. Mm-hmm. And it uses those instrumental sections to just carry that beauty that I'm talking about, that very somber beauty.
Yeah, yeah. They make you linger on that one for sure. Yeah, and then it wraps up with, we've mentioned it already, Hands on the Wheel, which leads into the Bandera, which is an instrumental. Which,
like, not to Hands on the Wheel is so fucking hard. Like,
yeah.
So,
I mean, that's if anything's timeless on this, it's all timeless, but Hands on the Wheel just makes you think about your life on a very visceral level, like today. Just put that one.
One of my least favorite things an album can be is front loaded, like throwing all of its bangers in the beginning. And this album is definitely one for me where it stays good throughout, but to like have I was not expecting a song like that to just flip my fucking wig right there at the end, because every line, the vocalizing and how it grows in intensity, you know, of just like this, the ending of this like character arc we've been following, it's just real fucking great. And just like I was talking about earlier of like the sound that like comes in with one of the vocals. Yeah, like it's a moment there in this song that's just so gorgeous, where I just love the melodies here especially.
Now my hands on the wheel of something that's real, and I feel like I like how it's like
you know, like I think Willie's style and the style that he kind of like picked up on with the songs that he chose to add to this, to record for this that were other people's, like it's very plain, you know, everything's kind of laid out there, and you pick up a wealth of meaning from these very simple words. And but this song is a little different in that it's a little surreal. There's some things that don't really like make sense on a specific level, which is like, again, like we kind of told the story how it goes, but that's the beauty of it, is it is kind of like up to your imagination to finish it, you know. And in this song, like it has some lines in there like you know, in the shade of an oak down by a river sit an old man and a boy setting sail, spinning tails and fishing for whales with a lady they both enjoy. You're like, what does that mean? It's got this kind of like almost like weird sexual vibe, but it's also could kind of like wholesome, like it could just be like, you know, parents and the kid, or, you know, like, but like, why, you know, it's said in a way that like it's just a little surreal.
Oh yeah, like it feels
maybe the lady is something else, like maybe it's an abstract concept,
like, you know? To me it definitely feels very like, I think surreal is the right word for it, because for me it feels like it's this character having a dream that's like a summation of his journey in a way, where the lines aren't necessarily supposed to make sense, but stuff is supposed to like be visuals of what his mind is at currently.
Yeah, and you know, implying that he's an old man at this point, where your mind might not be as sharp as it was. So that's where the surrealism really works.
Yeah, definitely.
To add such depth to it, you know. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah.
This album's really good.
Yeah, no, I'm very appreciative of you picking it, because I've been wanting to like get Willie peeled for a while, and this is a hell of a record to get that with.
Yeah, and I'll give you this recommendation, because I don't know if it's something I would pick for the show, but I don't want to call it a sequel, but there's an album he released a few years later in like the early 80s called Tougher Than Leather. And it very much, you know, like it follows the same kind of structure, where there's like the motifs and stuff like that. It's hard not to call it a sequel, because it does use, there's a lot of
similarities. Is there more killing?
There is some killing. There's some stuff that goes down in an old Western town.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's really good too. It's got, I think, more songs that I would say are better, that are like standalone songs and stuff.
Cause
like
off
that.
Of this and, some of the more like some of the songs you had on your track ones playlist, I definitely want to just check out. Like, I already wanted to like get more into like country and music that's like parallel to that sound, but like just knowing that there's so much gangster shit as a part of it makes me want to check it out even further. I don't know what it is. Yeah. I've never killed anyone, but I love music about it. I don't know what that says about me.
Well, no, me too. I listen to a lot of that stuff. Yeah. And there, I mean, yeah, there's something about it. Just like there's a whole genre of like, you know, murder ballads that it's super popular with country fans. Yeah. You know?
And you just like we talked about earlier, you just wouldn't know because there was never much uproar about this kind of music talking about it. I just assumed rap and some rock, like satanic rock or just heavy metal, was the only stuff where you really ever have an artist or a singer talking about that kind of stuff, you know. But
it definitely kind of bar, like it's a tradition, you know, like that goes back into like you know, even
boogeyman tales
hundreds of years ago. Yeah,
because like, you know, the tales are generally there to like discourage people from committing murder, which is the part that I think people forget about when they talk about music, about that that goes into that kind of crime. It's just that this isn't a motherfucker saying do it. These are the outcomes of it. Because we were talking, like you brought up Geta Boys earlier. Scarface makes me never want to kill anyone. Because way he raps about it, the PTSD that he goes into of every song about it, it's not fun.
I mean, I don't know. Like, it seems like we keep having to have this conversation. Like, even like the movie Oppenheimer. Like, they didn't show the nuclear bomb blowing people's faces off and melting them to a puddle. So you say it's, you mean it's good?
I'm
right?
Like, man, they got Cillian Murphy, the most nervous looking in Hollywood, playing him. You telling me we need to see some dead bodies to make that point? Like, come on, like, I mean, let's be real.
Yeah. So I think at this point, like, you know, going forward, you know, I feel like if you're on the same page with us, very good. But if you're not on the same page, you know, I don't think we're going to have to walk through this anymore. Like, it's almost like it's tiresome for both of us, I'm sure, to have to, like, even acknowledge that. Like,
it's a conversation that has to be had constantly because, unfortunately, we live in a country where there are people who are committing terrible acts and we don't want to blame anything but this. We won't blame anything but the institution. And Redheaded Stranger is just a great example of like how powerful music can be when you choose to talk about these very difficult things and look at it from a humane perspective too, you know?
You're looking at it as a study of a human, you know.
This isn't Pope.
Yeah.
You know, this is like a very real character despite he doesn't have a fucking name.
Yeah.
Which is like something that's shocking about it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and yeah, that's like maybe why like the movie, like I almost am fine not having seen the movie. I have to really separate the works because it does like give a weird backstory about like an old Western town and the mayor is like stealing the water or something like that, you know. But, you know, it is what it is. It's fine. I do want to watch it one day, but I'm definitely not going to be like, this is telling me anything. This isn't telling me anything about the album that I already did.
Yeah.
You know, I already knew what I need to know about the album, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly.
Real quick, I just want to kind of throw a little bit more love to Bobby Nelson and her work.
Yeah,
on this album.
Cause I also want to hear about her and like some of the other people who were involved with this album.
Yeah. Yeah. And in that case, well, I'll kind of go down like, you know, There's a lot, you know, like Paul English did the drums along with his brother Billy English, and Paul English is like Willie's best friend.
Sick names.
Yeah, Paul, aka the Devil, that was literally his nickname. And there's a couple of Willie songs that shout out the Devil, but and Me and Paul is another song about their friendship. But he's like just oh my gosh, I would love to talk just about Paul. Like you would love him. He's the craziest figure ever. Like he literally shot Willie's former steel player for like I don't even remember what he did, but like, he shot him because he was like a drunk and trying to start a fight, basically. I mean, the guy, he's a good player and everything, but he got a little out of control. And like Paul like literally shot him like in the foot or something, or like maybe like shot the side of him, I guess. Either way, it's still crazy. So that's just the kind of guy. You just got to look up a picture of him. He's got these crazy sideburns and hat. And then you got Jody Payne playing guitar and B. Spears. B. Spears is another character. There's a famous story about B. Spears. Willie has one of my favorite Willie songs. It's Angel Flying Too Close to the Ground, which isn't on a proper album, but it's a very tender song that he still plays today. And at one point, like they're doing it in a concert and like they had prearranged this without Willie knowing, where B. Spears was on a harness. And as soon as he talked about like the angel flying too close to the ground, B gets lifted up and like starts flying around the stage completely to Willie's surprise. So yeah, you got a lot of good characters. And Mickey Raphael, he's like one of the original family band members that's still playing today. Mm-hmm. Everyone else has passed away, unfortunately. But yeah, so Bobby, though, I think she, like, again, I'm kind of getting my cues from John Spong, who was the host of that One by Willie podcast I mentioned. Mm-hmm. But the importance of Bobby is, like, you can almost credit Willie's blowing up to Bobby solely, because the first thing he did when he got creative control from Atlantic was make an album of just gospel songs with his sister, because there was a period where Bobby basically wasn't allowed to play music because her kids got taken away from her because she played in bars. Like, that's the kind of like trauma and stuff that she's going through. Like, she also had a son die and stuff like this. She went through a lot of stuff in her life. And the fact that like Willie is like, I want to play gospel songs with my sister, as I can do whatever I want. That's what I'm doing first. Mm-hmm. And it ended up coming out as the album, The Troublemaker. It came out a few years later on actually Columbia after he made the switch. But yeah, like, her playing is so insane on this. And like, one particular moment that really, like, I really listening to this closely, there's on the song Redhead Stranger, there's a part where he's like, the yellow haired lady came down to the tavern. Mm-hmm. And then she comes in right as she's saying that to kind of like play like a honky tonk piano riff. Like,
yeah.
So like, just stuff like that is all over. Like, her playing is really good and it's really tasteful as well. And I think Willie would even credit her as being like the musical prodigy of the family, because she really knew her stuff and was like a walking songbook as far as like not just gospel, but like, you know, the old standards that he loved and all that. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, no, that's
just fucking really, really important part of this album. If you listen to it, yeah, really pay attention. Not because Willie's guitar takes kind of like center stage for obvious reasons, but her piano is like right there backing him up the whole way.
Yeah.
I mentioned Tougher Than Leather. Also, there's a live recording of this album that was recorded for an episode of Austin City Limits. You can check that out on streaming, and they play through the whole thing in order, which is really cool too. I was going to say, do you have anything else before when we wrap this up? Because I did want to talk about some connections between the two albums we talked about.
No, you can that was something I definitely want to go into. So yeah, feel free to get into it.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well, there's a couple of kind of like simple things, like you know, and
they both have Roger Troutman going, "Baby, shake it, baby."
The red-headed stranger. Oh yeah. But yeah, like there's a line in on Method Man's verse of "Mind Made Up." Mm-hmm. I think that's the name.
Yeah.
He goes, Johnny Blaze out to get loot, like Johnny Cash. Obviously, Johnny Cash and Willie were good friends. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's something that I was even thinking about with you bring it up, Tougher Than Leather. To me, that's like the name of a Run DMC album.
Yeah.
Where,
yeah,
I think it's just so funny finding out where some of these things are coming from. Could be coming
from. You have the Outlaws, Tupac's group, and Willie is like founders of the outlaw country movement, mm-hmm. which is a kind of interesting connection.
Yeah, no. Which, like, because I definitely feel like they both have similar interests of using like themes and motifs in terms of like telling like not fables, but like stories that have like a lesson at the end of them, and not like you shouldn't do this thing, but like very much just being like, I experienced it, so you don't have to. Where Tupac definitely from more of a like a first person perspective, whereas Willie from a more omniscient perspective.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. There's a lot. They both have a lot of just laying their emotions down on the table.
Yeah, dealing with troubled minds, you know. You can tell these artists have been through a lot and they're leaving it all on the floor, you know.
Yeah. I mean, one of Willie's great songs is The Nightlife. The nightlife ain't no good life, but it's my life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I feel like Tupac very much encapsulates that song in basically every song where he's, you know, talking about, I want to try Alizé. Is it any good?
No.
seriously,
though. I mean, like, I'm very picky with liquor. That's my thing.
Yeah, no, I am too. I'm sure.
Like, I don't think I ever had anything that a rapper told me to drink and I enjoyed it. I'm trying to think, low key. Yeah, no, that is really coming to mind. You know, they both be smoking. Where if you're a child, listening to this and you haven't smoked weed yet, check out these albums.
Check out Weed, by the way.
Check
too.
Out Weed.
I'm just plugging that.
There's a lot of dispensaries depending on where you're living. If you live in Chicago, you can use your student CTA card.
If I need to move to Chicago and like set up a Willie. Like, well, I guess Willie Nelson probably has his own. He does have his own brand of weed. That he would be very like probably proprietary of it, but I want to, like, you know, like I've seen pictures of these like weed stores in New York that are like I don't know, like Family Guy weed or something like ridiculous mm-hmm. like that, you know? I don't know. but yeah, and then, you know, when you mentioned Willie and working with Snoop Dogg, I think they're close friends.
Yeah, no, which I think is so cool. I love so many. Snoopy is easily one of my favorite just people ever. And I just think it's cool that he has made that connection culturally, because I can't imagine two guys of either world being like cooler friends.
Yeah. And I really hope like that he's given, like, you know, to people that, you know, would think, oh, who's this old Willie Nelson guy? He's just the guy that smokes weed. He's a clown or whatever. That to me, like the fact that, you know, he even appeared at Willie's 90th birthday party, which is like a huge concert, 2-day concert at the Hollywood Bowl.
God, I was going to ask how old he was. Hearing that he's 90 is so crazy.
He's about to turn 91. Oh, wow. This, in a little bit.
I hope he makes it 100.
And just announced an album that's coming out. That's so awesome. Yeah, he ain't stopping. Yeah, he's still going.
Oh, yeah.
He's talked about, like, people asked you if you thought about stopping. He's like, yeah, I thought about it, but I just didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, it's as simple as,
like,
that.
Like, why?
He just wanted to keep going.
Yeah, exactly. That's so awesome.
Yeah, like, why stop? Yeah, I like it. So,
and that's like definitely an energy that, just bring another parallel that I feel like Tupac encapsulated as a rapper. If he was like still alive, I mean, just based on the fact that he released so much fucking music after he passed away, this guy was definitely planning to like drop as many albums as possible. Because I brought up a bit in the other part, like the album After All Eyes on Me, which is my personal favorite Tupac album, Don Kill Your Mahdi, was very much ready to go and be shipped by the time he passed away, unfortunately. And it's an album that had like such a weird reception, because since it was the album that came out right after he died, everyone was like, was this what he wanted? Like, is this really what he needed and stuff? And it feels like it's more of an expressive album of what he is and what he was about at that time period than All Eyes on Me, where I definitely recommend for anyone who loves All Eyes on Me or liked All Eyes on Me to check out that one, because I feel like you'll get more of that and even like more like preciseness of how to make it work without making it bloated, which it is bloated, just because like if I got out of the situation he did at the time he was in, I would have dropped a double disc album too. Ain't nobody stopping me. You know. It's a celebration.
Yeah.
It's a motherfucking gangster party.
Yeah. I need to check that one out immediately again.
Yeah.
Because I know like the covers inspired some other people too, like O3 Greedo.
Yeah, O3 Greedo. He just got free, which is so awesome.
Yeah.
Like what's funny is with that album, I got it on vinyl, and I remember the person. What I think is cool is that he changed his name right before he passed away, where the album isn't technically a Tupac album, it's a Machiavelli album. And the guy who at the record shop who was selling it to me or whatever, he didn't know that it was Tupac, right? He was just like, you know, you have to be really good to compare yourself to Christ. I'm just like, why are you working at a record shop? this isn't your place. But yeah, like, because the cover is an animated, not animated, what the fuck am I saying? It's a drawing. Is a drawing of Tupac as Christ being crucified with the explicit logo covering his yuha. Because a lot of people forget Christ had his balls out.
His willy. Yeah, yeah.
All right, we just lost all of our Christian listeners. it's the time of the preacher for us now.
Yeah. Right, we could have not talked more about gospel than this episode. So I don't know what you want from us. And then real quick, last little connection between that I have. In 2009, the National Recording Registry in the Library of Congress inducted both Tupac's song Dear Mama and the Redheaded Stranger album into their registry as a historic music that needs to be listened to. Well, music and other things, just recorded media. So,
yeah.
So there you go.
Which is cool, but I do want to go on a quick rant off of that.
Go.
Yeah, I love Dear Mama. Dear Mama's a beautiful song. If you have to say what is the best rap song ever, sure, go for Dear Mama. I just fucking hate that. I had a language arts teacher. Her name was Miss Bradley. She's probably dead. I don't care about doxing her. But like, she was a very terrible teacher, very abusive, like literally just terrible teacher. But one thing that she did, because she caught me listening to my free player to Tupac, she was like, she took it from me. And then the next day she tried to make example saying, if you're going to listen to Tupac, this is the only good rap song ever made. And then she started blasting Dear Mama while forcing us all to write 500 word essays, you know? And like, that sentiment has always followed me, because like, I see Dear Mama being known as the seminal Tupac song. Like this is the Pac song, but like, Mm-hmm. Dear Mama's a great song that, you know, definitely humanizes Tupac, but Tupac wasn't like, you know, a soapy, he wasn't a soapy rapper. And not that like Dear Mama, it's sweet. It's harmonious, you know, but yeah. All Eyes on Me and Don Quixote and hell, even Me Against the World fully showed a picture of what Pac is, a complicated individual that wanted to touch on so many aspects, where Dear Mama is now being used as like a quick escape of like, oh, I can enjoy Pac too without having to like think too much about myself as a person, where I am just upset that Redheaded Stranger was able to get in it totally as an album with a 3-person body count. But the Library of Congress or whatever, why the hell does Congress have a library? Can't bother to listen to the album that Dear Mama's from and realize that this whole album deserves to be there too.
No, that's totally fair. I think also it's like probably a very personal song that people have been like, yep, that's about me and my mom too. So we're just like,
it's like, it's not, your mom wasn't pregnant in jail. Yeah. Your mom wasn't a Black Panther. The story is his and hers, where I hate when people make that song about themselves. I really do.
Yeah. But
make your own song about your mama.
Yeah, write your
own song. Or just steal someone like Willie does all over this album.
No, I can totally see that. And like, it almost felt like on All Eyes on Me, he had to have like a follow-up to it where he does like a slow jam, I guess you would call it, if you had to call it something, where it's the... The one about Life Goes On.
Life Goes On, which, like, great song. But once again, like, it's not something that
one tiny slice of the picture.
And it's not as personal as I like Pac to be in that mode, which is like my favorite of that kind of sound. That album is I Ain't Mad at Ya. That song, gorgeous, beautiful record. Yeah. And
very personal.
One that I will even say is better than Dear Mama. I only say, like, if you really got to call Dear Mama the best rap song ever, I ain't going to stop you, but I will ask you to name 20 other Pac songs, because you should be able to.
Yeah.
He has so many good songs.
Well, yeah, and that too, yeah. Like, I think we mentioned it earlier when we were talking about Tupac, is like, yeah, like, he is very, very much wanted his crew to be a part of it, and I think Willie did that as well.
Yeah, no, that's a huge part that I think is really cool about both of them, is that they weren't obsessed with their individuality. Like, they recognized that they definitely had, like, a platform that was specifically theirs, but they loved nothing more than having a community be a part of it, to, like, make it work.
Yeah, for sure. I think we better wrap it up there. It was really fun talking about both of these. It was a journey, like going through listening to these and refamiliarizing with my pick and getting brand new eyes on yours. And I'm sure you experienced the same thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Where it was a blast to talk about both of these. Where All Eyes on Me is very dear to me, and I already feel Redheaded Stranger being very dear to me as well, just because I listened to it like almost like 10 times already.
Yeah. Well, if we have kids, we're definitely going to be singing them, both Redheaded Stranger and Ain't Mad at Ya.
Yeah.
Yeah. As they go to sleep.
I'm going to sing Wonder Why They Call You Bitch too much.
Because you won't go to bed when I tell you to go to bed. You wonder why I call you bitch.
Oh, fuck. We have fun here.
We have fun. Before we go here, I just want to plug our social media. Feel free to give us a follow over at Instagram at the GMS Pod, also on TikTok at the GMS Pod, and Twitter at the GMS Pod. And send us an email, thegmspod@gmail.com. If you'd like to give us any suggestions, let us know your feedback on the show. If you have any thing you want to share, feel free to send us an email. We'll leave that open and look forward to hearing from you.
And on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on, be sure to leave us 5 stars if you really like what we're saying. And even if you just like us, you know, and you didn't like the episode, just do it, because it helps us and it will help you by being able to say, hey, I listened to a 5-star podcast. I did this. This is my doing.
Yeah, not many people can say they listen to a 5-star podcast, so.
Not many. Like, you know, so many podcasts are 4.8, 4.9, but this is the first 5-star one.
Yeah, this is the first one. Yeah, thank you for that.
I call, I